Okay. Hi, everybody. Paul here with Next Day Q&A. So let's do a quick sound check. So, Kay Guerrero, can you unmute yourself and tell us if you can hear us, mate?
I have unmuted myself and I can hear you, Paul. Hello, how are you
Awesome.
today?
I'm very well, mate. And you?
Yeah, doing well, thank you.
Yeah,
Into
cool.
week 9 of work from home.
Week 9. Wow.
Yeah,
That's
which is good.
crazy, isn't it?
But it's becoming the new norm now, so slowly
Yeah.
getting into my groove, so
I
that's a good
saw
thing.
a I saw a one of those things, I think you call them a meme or whatever, today, and it said, "What's the most useless thing you bought in 2019?" And it was a 2020 planner.
Very true, very true.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Cool. All right, thanks, Kay. Let me just kind of just check someone else. Shelley, can you hear us, mate? We'll have to click the unmute button. Not sure if Shelley can hear us. What we might do is we might just check in with, let's say Renee, maybe Renee can do that. So, Renee Curran, can you hear us, mate?
Yep, Paul, how are you?
I'm good, thanks. And you?
Good, thank you.
Cool. Were you with us on Saturday?
No, I wasn't.
Okay,
Sorry.
so you're going to see this for the first time?
Yeah, I'm doing the summarized version.
The summarized version. Well, it's going to get even more rapidly summarized than you would imagine,
Yeah.
because we thought, how do we make this more interactive? So I'm going to see if I can get through this in half an hour and then talk to you guys about the particular parts of it that you want to talk about and walk you through some exercises if there's some volunteers for that. So we can sort that out in half an hour or so. What I'm going to do is, having done a sound check, I'm going to get underway because time would be of the essence. So, Saturday's session was about managing yourself through change, and we wanted to talk more about change in general than any specifics about the coronavirus and the changes that's brought up most recently, because the coronavirus is kind of a bit irrelevant from the point of view of, we're all going through so much change at the moment that when everything settles down, then what we're still left with is still rapidly accelerating technological change at a level that most people can't really comprehend or are not aware of. So managing yourself through change turns out to be a critically important ingredient that we're talking about. Of course, we put it on the program because on Saturday and Sunday, we were going to be together having our beautiful Inner Reflections workshop, all of us in a room together, 2 days of meditating and mindfulness and beautiful food and all that sort of stuff. And we couldn't do that. So this seemed to be the most appropriate thing. So we hopped into it, and basically, we went through a bunch of housekeeping rules, those kind of things, which you guys don't need to really spend too much time on right now. And then we outlined a schedule, which meant that we could kind of take a few breaks during the day, and then we hopped into it. And the first thing we addressed was a whole idea that I think that I'll be happy when things change. But that's really a myth, because the reality is, I'll be happy and then things will change. So when I make myself happy, then things change, rather than when things change, I'll be happy. So the reality is, this is an internal journey. This is a between your ears kind of situation. So we looked first of all at why it is that change is such an issue and such a problem, because it is the only known constant in the universe. And basically what happens is, with change, is that we struggle to figure out what is the likely outcome of a lot of the change. And we're hardwired as kind of, people walking through the forest 600,000 years ago. If we didn't spot danger, it could be fatal. And so that's why you can, spend all day and have everything go great. One negative comment from one person in a 5-minute piece of your 14-hour day can totally ruin your day, because we sort of handle on, we hang on to the negative thing. And that's because of this hard wiring that we're talking about. And in fact, it's true to say that we actually prefer a negative that we can handle We prefer that to uncertainty, because uncertainty, we don't know. So what happens is there's a bit of a scale. And if you can imagine yourself wandering through the forest, that probably makes it easier to get. And we go from wary to alert, to concerned, to anxious, to alarmed, to fearful. And really those things are based on the stories that we tell ourselves. And of course, what we often do is tell ourselves stories that are, you know, only vaguely related to the truth of what's actually going on. So we summarize that by saying, okay, so one day or day one, because you can decide. So from today onwards, it's either one day things are going to be right, or today is day one of me being the way that I want to be. So we started to look at a thing called the change curve, and this is pretty predictable. The people who study what goes on as far as change is concerned have come up with this sequence that we pretty much go through, that, you know, regardless of what it is, but the studies have mostly been done in trauma. So that's typically, you know, when someone's house burns to the ground, or, you know, a child is, you know, killed in a car smash, or, you know, terminal disease turns up, or those kind of things. And what we see is that people predictably go into shock and denial, and their energy raises, but then it hits home and they go through frustration and depression, and they sink really, really low. And then they start to experiment with how to live this way from now on, and start to make, you know, decisions about what could happen, and eventually integrate back into normal life. So it's a pretty predictable thing. It's called the change curve. It's very closely related to what you might have seen us talk about in the past, in terms of the thing called the shock diagram. And the reality of this is that people can stay in the bottom part of that curve for many, many years. So it's a thing that we need to get control of, because it's purely attitudinal. It doesn't have anything to do with the circumstances we find ourselves in. It has everything to do with how we tackle it, whether we feel empowered, whether we feel depowered, you know, what we feel like we can do it, how much say we've got in what's going on. There's a whole bunch of variables, which we're going to look at shortly. So another way of looking at this change curve is to take the curve, the red line, and say, okay, we can actually divide that into four pieces and say there are stages you're going to go through. So there's that shock and denial, top left-hand box, and then the box underneath that, the one with a yellow colouring, that's where you'll see that there are strong emotions going on, uncertainty, anger, but you'll see behaviours like compliance or resistance or sabotage, which are kind of like compliance is where we go along with it, and resistance is where we fight against it, and sabotage is where we actually try and, you know, ruin it, pardon me. And then the box on the right of that, where that has acceptance and exploring and new ways in it, those emotions can be high as well. But essentially what we see there is people starting to figure out what I could do, what might work, and how I might be able to make a winner of the situation. And then top right-hand corner, commitment to a process, or an angle of attack, or a strategy, or a method, or something like that. Now, the purple dotted line is the way we could go if we knew what we were headed into. In other words, if we looked at it and said, okay, this is going to cause upheaval, how do I get through it the most quickly? It's to understand what happens in those four boxes. So I'm going to take each one of those four boxes just quickly and look at it. I've colored them so you could tell which one we're dealing with. We're going to go to orange first. So, you know, I'll just look at each box. And essentially what happens if you end up in the shock and denial box, then what happens for most people is there's some form of either withdrawal or business as usual or focusing on the past. In other words, what you'll see is these behaviours are all pretty negative. And, you know, that's probably understandable, but nevertheless, we know that's going to happen. So when you take bad news to somebody, that's pretty much what you can expect to see from yourself or them. When we go to, okay, well, what would work better than those kind of things? Then what works better than withdrawal is seeking information. What works better than business as usual is listening to expectations about what's going on. And what works better than focusing on the past is getting advice on how we adjust and what might be different and what we can do about it. And what might work better than being busy without getting a result is creating time to think and to understand what's going on and to see if we need to change direction, change strategy, change focus, pivot, do those kind of things. These things all get to be pretty important in terms of strategy. And, you know, there's a thousand stories about what you might be able to do. The one that that appeals to me most of all is that just recently a pizza place near us up in Queensland, had their turnover go to zero because, you know, no one was around. So they constructed and built a drive-through and then advertised to everybody, you pick up your pizza. When you turn up, all you have to do is pop your boot. We'll put the pizza in the boot. You can pay by credit card before you get there. It'll be zero contact, and away they went. They had to ring people up and say, listen, we're an hour and a half behind that. I asked people to stop ordering. Their business just went through the roof. And it went through the roof simply because of that pivoting. What they did was they had the advantage of, okay, rather than activity without results, we actually don't even have the ability to be in activity. So we need to look at pivoting. So pretty quick journey across that purple line. If you look at the second square, then essentially what you see there, and this is in the bargaining and resistance and anger area, you'll see high-level emotion. You know, extreme emotions express sometimes extremely badly, and those emotions can go as far as depression. You can even see active obstruction. You know, in America at the moment, there are protests about the lockdown, despite the fact that, you know, they've got the worst kill rate in the planet. There are people still out protesting, say, oh, I've got a right to be able to go to the beach or the whatever. So, you know, active obstruction is kind of one of the things we can expect. What would actually be better than anger and blame is self-reflection and acknowledging that our feelings are real, but they may not be that reliable and they may not be that appropriate. And what's better than anxiety and depression is looking to see who we can get support from, who we can share with, who we can feel understood by, who we can just talk and share stuff with. And what's a lot better than active obstruction, of course, is developing actions that increase understanding and increase our ability to move forward. So that's that square. We go to the next square, which is kind of like, you know, bottom right-hand corner. In the testing and exploration phase, what we find is that at this stage, energy starts to flow more naturally and people start to come up with ideas about what they might be able to do. But those ideas tend to lack focus or direction, or you know, they're not final, you know. So what happens is we get confusion because we're still learning. We're not there. We've left where we were. We haven't arrived where we need to go. So there's a feeling of unfamiliarity and confusion. Strategies at that level, basically what we need to do is focus on short-term goals. You know, it's really important that as we start to, you know, manage change, that what we do is we get our goals set in the short term, because we just need to kind of get through the current situation. We just need to be able to focus on what have I got to do right now. Of course, what's really important is that training is used where possible, or where we can see that it's going to have an effect or becomes necessary. And of course, we kind of, you know, we need to get into, you know, stretching our vision, planning, brainstorming sessions that are going to enable us to figure out what we might be able to do, where we might be able to go, things that are kind of open. There's no real hard and fast decisions made. There's lots of exploration kind of happening. And then in that final square on the top right-hand side, what you'll see there in the acceptance and commitment stage, the behaviours are a lot more coordinated. We see people, you know, channeling their energy together. Input becomes not just cooperative, but it becomes proactive in terms of working ahead of the situation and anticipating things. People start to get committed and they start looking for what might be the next challenge, the next level. What, you know, having come up with what we've come up with, what could we do after that? And in fact, I was just talking in a coaching session this afternoon about a guy who's got a pivot. He's in training people how to ride motorbikes. That's just basically vanished. About 150 grand's worth of business per year vanished. And I talked to him about taking people on educational rides. He jumped onto that idea, but straight away his brain went to, oh, and after that I can do this and I can make a course and I can do a book and a whatever. So we can start to see that people start to rise to the occasion. Strategies then should focus around longer term goal setting because it becomes much more relevant at that point. And we should look at making sure that we're working on building team and building team commitment, because it's when you coordinate your team that you start to see things really rocket ahead. And one of the great things for doing that is creating a mission statement or a sense of vision about where we and the business are going. So if you want to summarize all of that, then basically by the time we got to morning tea, what we were talking about is, you know, you can't change what's going on around you until you change what's going on within you. So the change curve was all about understanding that it's predictable, it's understandable, but it's highly unproductive to go through the kind of emotions that sink us and depress us. And it's useful to get going into the places where we can start to focus our effort on what we need to be doing and where we need to be going. So that got us through morning tea. And then we started to look at emotions and change. And I pointed out the whole idea that as emotions rise, intelligence goes down. It's a great way of saying this is actually what a lack of emotional intelligence looks like, is that, you know, the crazier I get, the worse I behave. So when you take that and you start to put it together with change, and what you'll see is that change by itself, it creates unpredictability. We're just not sure how it's going to work, you know, what's going to happen and how it's going to translate. And that unpredictability simply leaves room for people to interpret what's going to happen. And this is where things go haywire, because people who are risk averse, they start assuming that there's going to be massive loss, that things are going to go wrong, it's all going to be a disaster. And people who are pro-risk, they start to assume that there's an adventure happening and there's a lot of excitement about to take place. And what you've got is two people with a different approach to the same circumstances. And what happens is that they then start to battle with each other about who's got the correct interpretation. And then the battle goes personal. And once the battle turns personal, then we lose any kind of sense of being able to work with it positively to get a better solution. And part of the reason behind that is that logic goes out the window. But it goes out the window because it was never present in the first place, because the approach, the two opposite approaches, simply mean that we've got two people who are right and two people who are wrong, and they can't figure it out. They can't see it. So they start to argue about, why are you taking that view? Why do you always see it that way? And of course, the situation goes down the toilet and things get worse from there. However, when change is non-threatening, we start to embrace it, because what it does is starts to ease our equilibrium. And I use the example of, you know, a smartphone. Basically, smartphones took over the world and nobody knew. And the reason behind that was that what smartphones did was they made life easier. And they made life easier because you didn't have to go down to the bank to do your banking, and you didn't have to go to the post office to get your mail, and your weather came straight to you, the news feed, all that sort of stuff. So smartphones got embraced because of what they could do on our behalf. And yet I would say that smartphones have created the single largest identifiable change in our culture in the last 50 years. Bigger than the internet, bigger than all, you know, bigger than many, well, I think bigger than anything, because of the fundamental change to the way we live our lives and the things we do and we don't do. You know, it's very rare that you see anybody standing in a queue anywhere nowadays without staring at their phone or checking on Google about what they're going to do or any of that kind of stuff. So here is a massive change that was basically embraced wholeheartedly. Of course, there were the doubters and the people who are pointing out how bad it is, but, you know, they're in a minority. And so really what happens is, the way to summarise this is to say, as uncertainty increases, then what happens is our equilibrium gets increasingly disturbed. And that's when the manure hits the mistral, so to speak. If you're not sure what a mistral is, it's a fan. Okay, so when we look at that, that unpleasant feeling about, you know, I don't know what's going to happen next, I can't predict, for most people starts to trigger fear. What happens then is that unpleasant feeling, whether it's fear or whether it's anxiety or whether it's some other version, doesn't really matter. What happens is we go out of our way to suppress that unpleasant feeling, mostly because we don't like it so much that we get compelled. And as we get compelled, then what happens is we push it, we suppress it. But if the change is continuing to increase, then basically we step out of responding and we go into reacting. And reacting is when things get bad, because you see, increasing reactivity means decreasing sensibleness, decreasing common sense, decreasing thoughtfulness. Reactivity is kind of like, don't think, just act. And any action is better than doing nothing. And that's what leads to the, you know, the punch-ups in the supermarkets about the toilet rolls, all those kind of things. So essentially, if we graph that, then what you'll see is that, you know, if we put time along the bottom and increasing change going up the left-hand side of this rectangle, then essentially what happens is that we start to become uncomfortable as change accelerates. So I'm going to put a couple of lines on here. They'll be here in a second. And essentially, the first line is what I reckon is a reasonable approximation of the rate of change at the moment. But of course, I'm talking the last 50 years up until now. So that green line, basically, we could argue about how steep it is at which point, but I'm suggesting to you that we could all sign up for there's increasing change going on in as much as it's exponential. That being the case, then what we need to look at is how do we get to this discomfort and confusion and that kind of stuff? Well, it doesn't actually have to do with the green line. It has to do with the red line, which I haven't put on the graph yet. The red line represents our preferred rate of change. Now, you might like that red line to be a bit more level or a bit more steep or whatever, so we could argue about the details there. But essentially, what happens is you'll see that, if I can move my cursor, I hope you can see my cursor, but essentially discomfort for most people takes place, of course, at different times, different circumstances. But what we're talking about is once the green line or your sense of the green line goes above your sense of the red line. So yours and my senses of the green and red line can be in different places. But once the green line for me goes above my red line, then I start to feel discomfort, then confusion, then anxiety, and then outright fear and terror and et cetera. So I would say my rough estimate based on working in the field that I'm working in, those kind of things, is that we are well beyond discomfort. And we're right into confusion. And of course, you know, every day you can go out there and you can see people who are anxious and they're resisting what's going on. And you can see people who are in outright fear and you know, so much fear they don't even know what to do about it. Those people, their green line is way up above their red line. That just so you can go at whatever speed, but basically this truism holds true. And that is that when the change is going faster than we prefer or we like, we get all out of kilter and we go crazy and we try and change it and we try and slow the change down, which is fair enough for some things, but, you know, for many things you can't. And so, you know, you cannot stop your children getting older. You can't stop the economy doing whatever it's going to do. So there are a lot of things that are out of our control and a lot of people waste a lot of time trying to control those things. What I'm going to suggest to you is we can summarize all of that by saying, you know what? If you want to change the world, if you want the world to be a different place, then what you will do is you will look at changing yourself and your approach to the standard belief patterns that you allow to rule your life, whatever they might be. So when we look at that, the skills for change, basically, we don't have a great sense of imagination. Henry Ford's famous for saying, if I'd have asked people what they wanted, they'd have said a faster horse. So look at it from this point of view. Initially, when you went to school, at the time that you went to school and high school, that kind of stuff, you would have been aware of how smart or dumb you were or how intelligent you were. And it would have appeared that, you know, the smart kids were going to do better in life. At least that was a kind of implication. But about 25, 30 years ago, it became obvious that there are plenty of geniuses who are broke and whose relationships don't work and whose lives don't work. And, you know, there are plenty of geniuses out there who don't make it. And so researchers and scientists came across emotional intelligence, and what they realized, what the conclusion they came to, is that basically nowadays we can look at emotional intelligence and say it's the only known predictor of future success. And so the better your EQ, then the better your life will run, the more it will go the way that you want it to. But essentially that's been overtaken by another concept as well. And that is a new big predictor of future success now is your adaptability quotient. How quickly can you change? How quickly can you pivot? How quickly can you say, okay, what used to work is now a dead duck. We need to turn and face in a different direction. That concept there means that we have to embrace change from the point of view of understanding it's inevitable, that resistance is predictable, and that the only sensible approach is to be expecting change. Because if we're not expecting it, it's going to sideline us. Therefore, the summary that we took into lunchtime, I think it was that your adaptability quotient is directly proportional to your ability to let go of what exists already without experiencing a sense of loss. your willingness to embrace not just possible failure, but very, very likely failure out of a small number of your projects, and understanding that permanence in terms of things being constant means being petrified, that you know, you'll just become a dinosaur and that'll be the end of it, and that what you need is calmness in the face of unpredictability. And I was at great pains on Saturday to point out that we can't predict anyway. The whole idea that we know what's going to happen in the future, the whole idea of being afraid of the unknown is a ridiculous concept, because we can't know anyway. So that means that, you know, those of us who are going to make it are going to be the ones who have the ability to be present. It's your ability to stay in the moment and deal with what's happening right now that actually determines how well you go with change. So what I said is, what we need to do is we need to replace predictability, and we need to turn it into excitement and adventurousness. We need to think about the inevitability of things developing into something that they were never quite like when they started. We need to expect quantum leaps propelled by technology, you know, like the progress from propellers to jet engines, the progress from taxis to Uber, you know, crazy stuff like that, quantum leaps. We need to understand or find out what is our new normal, and we need to adjust to that accordingly so that we can master the skills of whatever that new normal is, and at the same time figure out how to support people who are struggling, the people all around us. What that means is your values are your compass for your decision-making process. That your values are actually going to be the only thing that you take into the future with you that's predictable. That's a profound concept. From that point of view, it's easy for us to say, a year ago, I couldn't have pictured my life the way that it is now. We then went on and took lunch, and then we went on to basically a whole bunch of factors affecting change, which I'm not too sure how quickly I can get through this. Firstly, the impact on me and, you know, just how profound that might be. Secondly, the level of control that I feel like I have. And I went on to point out that many people spend a lot of time trying to control things that are outside of their control. So we need to be aware of what's being done to us as opposed to what we feel like we're participating in. We need to look at our opportunity to contribute, because, you know, if we can buy into the change initiative, then that allows us to feel like our contribution is valued, and we're much more likely to participate in change when it's happening at that level. We also need to look at our perception of it, you know, because if we believe the change is positive, we're likely to behave positively towards it. But if we feel that it's negative, then we're probably going to resist it and all that sort of stuff. We can change that perception pretty easily. When we look at the ultimate purpose of change, basically what we can say is, even if change is unpleasant or uncomfortable, you know, we can still go along with it if we agree that there's an ultimate purpose that's better for a bigger, larger people, or, you know, it's going to work more for more people. Then we can say to ourselves, well, there's some ultimate good in it. There's some higher purpose to that, and I can get involved. And we can look at our expected result and say to ourselves, okay, so how do I bring enthusiasm to the situation instead of negativity? How do I, you know, because often what people do is they expect us to go for it even when something may not even be in our own personal best interest, but it's in the interest of the group. And that can make us feel wrong sometimes when we voice, you know, concern about it. Number 7, in terms of factors affecting change, is how often it is. So, you know, often one-off change for short periods are, you know, easier to manage than if the change feels like it's just constant and it's change for change's sake, and it's just, you know, no one's able to get used to anything being stable or any of that kind of stuff. The other thing that affects it is how much information is available, because when we have more information, we feel like we have more control. And if we feel like we have more control, then we feel like we're a part of the process, that there's, you know, nothing's being hidden, it's all transparent, and we can work with it easily. And of course, if we have the tools, then we can go a whole lot better with it. So when people are left to handle change by themselves, but they don't have any tools or techniques or processes, then they find that really difficult. So it's important for us to train others or to get tools for ourselves. And then we have to allow for personality differences, because there are people who like change and there are people who don't. And we need to be aware that we all travel at a different speed, because if we don't grab that, then basically we miss a boat. But pretty much we're all going to go through the same process. And so some people are going to do it quicker than others. A lot of people are going to be looking for where you position yourself in the change process. And I'm going to suggest to you that we all need to become leaders, because change is inevitable, but changing with regard to change is not. And that's a thing that's key for us. Then have a look at your position on the change curve, because it's pretty important that you know where you are and you know how you behave, so that you can get into the leadership position, you start to play the bigger role in the impact. And then finally, I think was number 13, and that is motivation preferences. And those preferences are about how much change we like to take in the process, you know, how much we want to be involved and how much we don't. So we talked about change making us feel vulnerable. But that being vulnerable is where innovation and creativity and change actually take place. So we had a look at the work of a guy called Stephen Dilts, who said that basically there are levels that we can't get through, or we can't affect change if we can't get through them. And we work from the bottom up. And essentially, this is like Maslow's hierarchy of needs. And what it says is that basically environment, if you can't get your environment under control, if the circumstances are such that you can't have your environment how you want it, then change is impossible. And it's very difficult to think about the next level, which is how we behave. And so how we behave has got to do with what we say and what we do. Well, it's very difficult to be changing what we're saying and what we're doing if we feel like our circumstances are wrong. If we're in a workplace that's too noisy, or if we're in a workplace that's too loud, or, you know, we're not appreciated, or there's not the tools and equipment that we need, then what we say and what we do is dramatically impacted by that. Next thing on that level is, you know, our methods and our strategies and our capabilities in terms of what skills we have and what we can bring to the argument or the change or whatever. And then there's our values, and that really means what matters to us and why we do what we do. And after that is the way we see ourselves, our sense of how we function in the world, you know, who we are. And finally, there's our ultimate reason for doing what we do, which is usually bigger than us. You know, for many people, we want to see the world be a better place because of our existence in that. So what you'll see happens here is if people can't get the place and the time and the circumstances and the environment the way they want it, what happens is they become disoriented. You know, if you subject people to enough noise, like industrial level noise, then what happens is they lose their sense of direction, they lose their sense of balance, they kind of become completely disorientated. When people can't behave the way that they want to and be authentic to themselves, then they get confused. When they can't use the tools that they've been able to use all their life, then what happens is they get extremely uncomfortable, so to speak. When their values are compromised, then what we find is extreme emotional upheaval. At one stage, I found myself unable to continue being a school teacher because my values were being compromised at that point. And so what that meant was every day was agony. So, you know, I was hardly paying attention to what I was doing because I was so deeply involved in how wrong the situation was, and I had to do something about it. You know, it came to a head, so to speak. So when our sense of ourself or the way that we function or who we are, when we can't get that sorted, then what that means is that we just lose our sense of direction, because we get our sense of direction a lot from by saying, I'm the kind of person who. And so when we can't do that, then that pretty much stops things. And of course, if our ultimate reason or our purpose or our focus is gone, then we completely lose motivation. So this is brilliant work. The guy's name is Stephen Dilts. His research is worth looking at, although you've seen the guts of it right there. That's the thing to understand, is that, we can't go to the red before we've sorted out the green. We can't get to the purple before we've sorted out the green and then the red. So it's a very progressive model, and it's one that I commend to you in terms of studying that, in terms of understanding yourself and understanding everybody else. When you can't understand why people are behaving the way they are, what you want to do is have a look on the left-hand side of that diagram and say to yourself, what are they exhibiting? You know, for example, are they confused or have they just lost direction? Are they disorientated or have they lost motivation? And if so, what that means is the thing on the right needs to be fixed. And so if they're extremely uncomfortable, then their methods and their strategies and processes are not working or haven't turned up, or they haven't been trained, or they've been asked to do something that they're not ready or feeling capable of doing. So this is a brilliant model for change. Use it for yourself and use it on other people as well. What we went on to say is the only known constant in the universe is in fact change, which means that to be afraid of the unknown is a ridiculous concept because we can't know. It's impossible for us to know what's going to happen tomorrow. Therefore, what we need to do is embrace the moment right now and see what evolves and happens tomorrow. That got us to afternoon tea time. Where after that, we started to look at how people behave when it comes to direction. And pretty much the people who focus on goals and achievements, they're likely to kind of go racing through. The people who focus on problems and risks and barriers and hurdles and difficulties, then pretty much what's going to happen there is that they are going to get focused on how difficult it is and start to kind of be perceived to be negative by others because they're going to want to block things. So this is a motivation by direction. We then wanted to have a look at motivation by time. And, you know, there are some people who just want a quick answer so they can get action on it right now. And that means that they tend to make things happen, but it means that they can also get frustrated when the action is not forthcoming. If you look at the other way to look at time, there are people who want to hang back and not be ripped, tear and bust. And, of course, what happens there is they're going to move slower through the whole thing. And as they move slower, then what that means is that, you know, they're going to kind of want to take time to look at how other people are doing it. They may feel pressured by people putting on the pressure to get moving and create action. Another source of motivation is a source. So where, you know, what that means is where are you getting your evaluation from? Where are you getting a sense of whatever? So people who've got a reliance on their own internal self, they're unlikely to be swayed by other people. And, you know, you're going to have to appeal to logic and be quite compelling. They're going to need strong reasons for that. People whose source is actually external, so they look for other people's feedback and, you know, what they've got to say, they are likely to need reassurance from other people, and they may actually struggle in times of change where there isn't feedback and validation for them or their process or what they're doing. People whose motivation comes from the approach, in other words, I want to stick to a system and I want to stick to a methodology, then what's going to happen there is they're going to need reassurance and direction from other people. They may actually struggle if the feedback and the validation isn't forthcoming. People whose approach is to get autonomy and find new ways of solving the problem themselves, they're going to look to the manager and other role models for guidance, and they may actually get uncomfortable until the new structures and procedures are in place and bedded down and operational. People whose motivation comes from response, their desire is going to be for things to stay the same. They are likely to want to find a way to contribute to the change discussions and shape its outcomes, but they could rebel if they feel like the change is being imposed upon them by other people. The people whose motivation comes from response, their desire for control change for a good reason means that they are very likely to resist change and try and find ways of keeping things the same. They may struggle to cope with too much change or regular change or impactful change. People whose focus is on the task, what you'll find with them is that they want to place their full attention on the process, the method, the technologies, and they can just basically bulldoze people and roll over them and get accused of lacking empathy. People whose focus is on the people involved and who's being left behind or damaged or whatever, they're going to concentrate on the people issues, and they may get sidetracked by those issues and they may lose a bit of objectivity with it. All of that can be summarised, not so much summarised, but what we need to say with this is everyone's got their approach. We need to look at a different approach for a different situation. In other words, we need to have a variety of approaches, because the reality is if you're going to be brave with your life, then you're going to fail at something. And so change means that we need to get ready to fail and fail quickly so we can move on and use failure as a process for getting to success. So I went and summarized the whole thing and said, okay, so when it comes to change, make sure you get the facts straight. Make sure you figure out what is inside your control and what is outside of your control. When it comes to the things that you can control, only focus on that. It's critically important that your focus is only on the things that you can have an influence over or an impact on. Understand the change curve and adapt to that and get to be able to be moving quickly. Because if you can't move quickly, then the curve gets to be deep instead of shallow. Make sure that you be objective. That relates to the top thing about getting the facts and keeping yourself cool and calm in the face of you know, all sorts of disaster, and remain logical as far as possible. But above all, be positive, because you know, if you can look for the greater good or the bigger picture or whatever, then you can make sure things happen better and sweeter, and you're going to have a much more positive impact on the people around you. And that may have a very powerful kickback on you. It's important that you stay in communication. And sometimes there are times when you've got nothing to say and you have to call a meeting to tell people that you've got nothing to say, because, you know, quite often the silence is going to get interpreted as no news is bad news. And that's not actually an example of you staying in communication. Above all, stick to your values, because otherwise it's like trying to hack your way through the jungle without a compass. And your values, as things change around us, your values are going to be the only thing you take into the future. In my personal opinion, your values are your most powerful possession, your most precious possession. And understand where you come from on the motivation scale, whether it's focus, whether it's time, whether it's solution, those kind of things. Because if you check where you are on those six levels that are identified by Stephen Diltz, then you can make sure you're working at the right level to be able to sustain change for yourself and the people that you want to be able to do that for. And then we went on to our worksheets, etc., and referred to the Facebook. What I would like to do right now, and I've managed to get through that in 45 minutes, that's 4 hours down into 45 minutes, is to actually work with any of you that you would like to through some of that kind of stuff. So my first question to you would be, what do you struggle with most? So one of you who feels like working on something tonight, we've got the opportunity to do that. All you have to do is unmute yourself and speak. We've got time for one or two of you to do this. We can probably get through this exercise with one or two of you. So is there anybody who would like to just get some personal coaching from me right now on this whole concept of change? Anything that you saw in that process or you have a question about? Okay, cool. Because we have the time, I'm going to ask each one of you one specific question, and we'll see how you go with that. Let's go to Kay Greer. Okay, can you hear us?
Yes, I can, Paul.
Cool, mate. What is the thing about change that you struggle with most?
It's the skill that I want, or some tips, is how to, I guess, more quickly recognize when I'm shifting out of what is my productive phase and sliding downhill into becoming non-productive, and then into those places of negativity and all of that sort of thing. So it's, I guess, recognizing, especially when external factors are more the influence.
Mm.
I'm not sure if that makes sense.
Well, let me see if I can summarize it. That'll find out. So essentially what you're saying is that sometimes don't recognize when you've slid out of proactive and gone into reactive. And that most likely happens when the external pressures are at the highest.
Yes.
Cool. Okay. Typically, when do you become aware of that happening?
I pick up on it when I start to get short with people around me, because I'm not normally like that, and it quite often it's a physical feeling. I won't feel comfortable. It's starting to feel that discomfort, but I'll be sitting in that discomfort for quite some time, or can be, without actually recognizing it. It's not just about change. I guess it's about change, but it's about conscious and unconscious need to change. It's about getting it, getting those things to surface for me quicker, so that I can change, confront it head on.
Yeah. Cool. All right. That's really good observation skills. So, the thing, I'll try and summarize it for you. The thing to become aware of is when you get a bit snappy and snarly, when that's so much not your character.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, the thing for you to pay attention to is when you get cranky, or when you get sharp, or when you get blunt, or however that is, but, you know, when you're not like you know yourself to be. Generally speaking, what we do is, and you know, this, if I go to Mary and me, she'll say, you know, what are you so cranky about? And I'll say, me? Well, it's you. You started it, or you, blah, 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 blah. And I'll blame her or the circumstances. So I might blame her and say she started it, or she said something, or whatever. Or I might say that it's, you know, the weather, or it's the people at work, or the whatever. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does.
Yeah,
it could be in my household.
And essentially what's happening is I don't know that it's me, because there's a reason for it. In other words, I'm saying the reason I'm cranky is because of you. Does that make sense?
Right.
Look, I'm cranky because of the weather, or I'm cranky because at work they told me they've got to do this extra job.
Uh-huh.
Now, because it was work telling me that I've got this extra job that they're not going to pay me for, but I have to do it anyway, I think that I'm cranky because of work telling me that I've got more work to do.
Uh-huh.
Instead of observing, I'm cranky.
Good point. Okay.
Got it?
Yeah.
See, because if I've got a reason, well, I'm allowed to be cranky.
Yeah.
So what it ignores is that, hang on, it's me who's, my equilibrium is upset. It's me who's out of kilter. And I'm saying, well, you know, if the people at work would just change their attitude, I'd be fine.
Yes.
And the trouble behind the problem with that is that now the people at work, at my work, they control my feelings.
Yep.
And so I go home and I have a horrible evening, and that's because I'm out of sorts and I'm blaming the work situation.
Mm-hmm.
So people right now are saying, you know, oh, it's really tough because the kids are at home.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a very sad thing when I exhibit bad behavior and then say it's because of some reason.
Uh-huh.
Because it's still bad behavior.
Yeah.
I was still rude. I was still nasty. And I let myself down.
Yes. Yep. Mm-hmm.
Therefore, the thing to understand is that the red flag to wave for yourself is I'm upset. If I'm upset, something's wrong. But I need to look inward instead of outwards.
Yeah, okay. Thank you.
And generally speaking, when you get cranky, it's because something is threatening you. Right, we get cranky when we mostly get cranky. You can write this one in capital letters. We mostly get cranky when we're scared.
Uh-huh.
Which is a ridiculous concept. Most people think they're cranky because of outrage. You know, I'm cranky because somebody said something. But really, I'm scared that I'm being diminished or lessened or demeaned or poked fun at or made fun of, or... You understand what I'm getting at?
Yeah, I do. And I think the other thing I would add to that as well is from a work perspective I'm referring to now is I was just reading something recently and it was about unmet expectations and things not happening the way I expect them to or yeah. I want them to, which is can be unreasonable on my part, but mm-hmm. I'll get cranky just the same.
Yes. I was talking to a guy the other day who's a perfectionist, and he said that he gets cranky with people who don't even return his phone calls.
Right.
And I said, okay, fair enough. But, you know, that's your perfectionist standards impinged on someone you've never met.
Yes. Yep. Makes sense.
And so the person who never returned the phone call now owns that guy's feelings. So he's at home grumpy, having dinner with his wife and his daughter, and everyone's having a shit of a time because somebody didn't return a phone call.
Yeah.
And so I said to him, look inside, what do you feel? And he said, I feel afraid. And I said, afraid of what? And he said, afraid that I'm not going to build the business to the level that it wants to be because I can't get the people to return the phone calls. Therefore, I can't build the business, blah, 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 blah. The reality is that unreturned phone calls were irrelevant. Does that make sense?
Yes. And it's interesting when you said that, I was thinking when you said look inside, and I've just realized what's triggered it today is that I'm not sure whether I'm doing a good job. That's
And that's what's triggered it. And that's really that uncertainty. That makes sense?
Yes. Yes, it does. Thank you.
Okay. So let me ask you one final question.
Mm-hmm.
You're entitled to feel uncertain about whether you're doing a good job or not, because, you know, maybe we have to wait until the job's finished to figure out whether you're doing a good job or not. So you're entitled to have some self-doubt.
Mm-hmm.
But the question is, have you given it a red hot go?
Oh, absolutely. Yep. Yeah.
Okay. Because that's it.
Yeah. Yeah.
If you've gone for it, if you worked hard, you know, it's one of the lessons that we want to get through our business. Everybody who works in our business is that it's traditional in our culture to value the result. But we actually would be a lot better off if we valued the effort.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because some days you're going to win and some days you're not.
Yep.
Does that make sense?
Yes, it does.
Great. Right. Thanks for playing, Kate. That's cool.
Thank you.
Cool. Renee Curran, let's have a quick chat, Renee.
Hello.
What part of change do you struggle with the most, mate? Or what kind of change throws you the biggest or whatever?
It's my normal one, which is the fear of the unknown, which you've covered off again tonight, in that you don't know what's actually happening in the future anyway. So it's the biggest thing that I always take out of it and trying to practice is the ability to be present. So whenever... Mm. At the moment, whenever I get really anxious about the unknown of what's happening with the business, is to really focus myself on what's happening today. I can only focus on what is happening today. And then what happens tomorrow, I can deal with that tomorrow. Mm-hmm. But still keeping in mind, I guess when you were talking about setting short-term goals at the moment, I really need to set those rather than keeping my mindset on those long-term goals. So at the moment, because there is a lot of change happening, I need to focus more on that rather than constantly looking at what the long-term goals are, because that's then what makes my mind tick more of what could happen. And things like that. So, trying to be more present and then yeah, not worrying about what others might be thinking, because it's mainly just in my head what I think others might be thinking.
Yeah, and generally speaking, we're not very good at figuring out what other people are thinking.
Yep.
What we tend to do is project our feelings onto them.
Yeah.
So when we're experiencing self-doubt, we assume that other people are doubting us.
Mm.
When we're experiencing a bit of confidence ourselves, we assume that other people see that we're confident or that we deserve to be. So, you know, it's kind of like we project our feelings onto others, imagining that that they've just got a different version of what we're feeling.
Yeah.
So where you'll experience a difficulty in that is we worry what other people are thinking, but then we go, they're probably thinking I'm a loser. They're probably thinking I'm a dumbass. They're probably thinking I'm going to fail. In other words, they're probably thinking, well, it's actually everything I'm thinking.
Mm. Yeah.
And you're entitled to think that, but you need to let the thoughts go through.
Yeah.
In other words, I'm thinking that I'm a dumbass, but, you know, let's just let that thought go through, because we don't have to engage with every thought.
Yep.
There are some thoughts that you can just let them go.
Yeah.
Like, I'm going to kill that kid. He's one of those thoughts you probably just, well, I'm sure you've had that thought, I'm going to kill that kid. And, you know, let's not absolutely say you've had that thought, but if you had have had that thought and the child is still alive, then the reality is that was a thought that you didn't pay attention to. That was a thought that you didn't engage with.
Yeah.
It's kind of like, I'm not going to kill him, but I think I'll put him in that drawer and lock it.
Yeah.
And then you go, no, I'm not doing that. I have to find something else.
Yeah.
And so that's kind of, we need to do the same with our thoughts of self-doubt or the thoughts that I'm stuffing this up or I'm going in the wrong direction or whatever.
Yeah.
Because the reality about the future and the unknown is not just that we can't know. It's also that we are, we're not equipped to be able to know.
Yeah.
You know that story I tell about I asked the girl to marry me and she said, no, I'm pregnant to someone else.
Yeah.
That was a bad day, mate. But then a few years later, I meet Mary and now that first day, that was a really great day.
Yes. Yeah.
But it took five years for it to change from a good day to a bad day. Well, sorry, from a bad day to a good day. But what it shows me is that at the time I had no ability to judge because I don't know what it's going to develop into. So where possible, what we have to do is we have to suspend judgment.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yep.
Because if you and Pete pivot the business and find some new income stream and that works really well, then all the worry is for nothing.
Yes. Yep.
If you can't, if the thing you're working on at the moment to pivot the business doesn't work, then what's the next thing?
Yes.
And then what's the next thing and what's the next thing and what's the next thing? The question is not, does your next thing save you? The question is, what do you do next? You know, I remember saying to my coach about 20 years ago, he said, how's the business going? And I said, mate, it all depends on the next thing we do. This next project is make or break. And he said, that's bullshit. He said, the next project is irrelevant. I said, no, mate, it's important. It's important to our financial survival. He said, if the next project is a winner, all that means is you survive for a little bit longer.
Yeah.
If the next project is a loser, all that means is you have to come up with a winner sooner. He said, it doesn't depend on the next project. It depends on the next 20 projects.
Mm. Yep.
And that's the reality of our life. You know, your parenting doesn't depend on the next thing that you do with your children. It depends on the next 20 things you do.
Yes.
Because the next thing you do with your kids could be hopeless. It could be great.
Yep.
Cool. Got that?
Yep.
Sweet. All right. Thanks for working with us on that.
No problem. Thank you.
Cool. Cool. Let's try one more. Let's go to Rick. Can you hear us, Rick? Rick can't hear us. Let's just go to open questions. So do any of you have... Oh, there you are, Rick.
Yeah.
Can you hear us, Rick?
I can hear you. Can you hear me?
Yeah, nice and clear, mate. Sounds like you're in the room next door, actually. What is the thing that you struggle with most in terms of change, mate?
I don't know. I love change.
Yeah? That's cool. What is it you like about change? Because I'm sure there are people who are listening who would love to know.
Oh, it's just new things coming along all the time and seeing people create new innovations and things. I would love to be abreast of new technology and ways of doing things, and I really embrace it. That's good.
Uh-huh. Cool. Well, I reckon that's a really interesting point. You know, it's kind of like that is an attitude that anyone could maintain, is that change could be exciting. That's a fascinating concept. Do you know how come you like that? Like, is there an attitude that you have or a mindset that you bring to that?
Not consciously. But,
have you always been like it?
I guess it just takes you out of the humdrum. day-to-day existence, that there's something new happening, and it's something that's, if there's something interesting or beneficial to other people or to the world or whatever, then I'd just love to see that coming into fruition.
The reason I laugh is you sound like my mum. She's 92, and all of my life she has loved change. And so every 4 or 5 or 6 weeks, the lounge room would get rearranged, all the chairs would get put out, you know, the TV would get moved. My dad was forever bloody, you know, moving stuff and carrying on about it and whatever. But mum just wanted it to be different just so that it was different.
Yeah, my wife's a bit like that, but I'm quite comfortable in my surroundings, and I can get a bit complacent with that, with a bit of mess around or whatever. But it's technological change, I guess, and thought processes that change, and you know, people that have great inventions or new philosophies or whatever that come along, they're great.
I think we all embrace change when we can see the benefit for us. If you look at lots of people being sent home to work from home because of coronavirus thing, and you know, lots of people being sacked, and you know, lots of businesses shutting their doors, then the change is not kind of like seen as, you know, this is a new exciting way to be. It's the only people who make it into a new exciting way to be are the people who go, hey, you beauties, homeschooling, you know, we'll see more of the kids and, you know, that kind of thing. Until there's a personal benefit, then most of us are going to fight against it and want things to go back to being the same old way.
Yep.
Cool. All right. Thanks, Rick. Say again?
Something positive.
Yeah. Well, we need to make it into something positive, I reckon. Thanks for that, Rick. Let me just ask, are there any other questions of any kind? Because we've used up most of our time, or we've used up all our time. So what I'd like to know, are there any questions before we call it an evening? Okay, great. Let's call it an evening. Thank you for your participation, particularly Renee and Kay and Rick, for playing along with us. I hope that tonight's been valuable for you. It's called Next Day Q&A, and we'll talk to you soon. Good night, everybody.
Good night. Thank you.
Thanks, Paul.
Good night. Bye.